All right, we call the next case Williams v. Thaler, and we hear first from Mr. Sullivan.
May it please the Court, James P. Sullivan for the Director. The District Court violated AEDPA's most important provision, 2254D, when it granted federal habeas relief to Nainan Williams. Recent Supreme Court precedent makes clear that the judgment should be reversed. A state court convicted Williams of murdering Collier with a shotgun in
Counselor,
a drug deal.
Do you say we should reverse and render, or what?
Judge DeMoss, I believe you should reverse and render. As we say in the concluding paragraph of our brief, we cite 28 U.S.C. 2106 and cite a number of cases in which the Fifth Circuit has said it reversed and rendered in federal habeas cases involving state prisoners. And we think that that's appropriate here because 2254D doesn't leave any authority to grant habeas relief in this case. Now, as I say, the state court convicted Williams of murder, and Williams claims ineffective assistance under Strickland, arguing that trial counsel should have called certain forensic experts. To show prejudice under Strickland, Williams has to show a reasonable probability that the result of trial would have been different had these experts been called. But showing Strickland prejudice is not enough to win habeas relief here, because a state court has already rejected this Strickland claim. In Harrington versus Richter, the Supreme Court explained what overcoming the relitigation bar of 2254D would entail. And as an aside, when I say relitigation bar, I'm referring to what's sometimes called AEDPA deference or the standard of review. So in Harrington, the court explained that Williams would have to show that the CCA's rejection of his Strickland claim was, quote, so lacking in justification that there was an error well understood and comprehended in existing law beyond any possibility for fair-minded disagreement, end quote. This is a remarkably high standard, and Williams can't meet it. So 2254D leaves the federal courts with no authority to grant habeas relief in this case. Now, to read the opinion below, the second opinion by the district court in this case, the court will not really find any explanation of just how 2254D standard has been satisfied. And that's because the district court's opinion is a great deal like Judge Reinhardt's opinion for the Ninth Circuit that was reversed in Harrington versus Richter. Here, as in the Ninth Circuit's opinion in that case, the district court reached an independent conclusion on the federal law question, here, whether there was a valid Strickland claim. And then, without any word of explanation as to why this would be true, the district court simply concluded that if the CCA found otherwise, then it was unreasonable. But as Justice Kennedy wrote for the court in Harrington, quote, AEDPA demands more, end quote. And so AEDPA demands more, and that work is going to fall to this court to do, to try to figure out whether this very high standard of 2254D has been satisfied.
Okay, the issue here is prejudice, right?
Respectfully, Judge Davis, I would say that the issue is not quite prejudice. The issue is whether the state court could reasonably conclude that there was no prejudice, and we believe that there is a difference. To independently conclude whether there is Strickland prejudice is really irrelevant in this case. And I think that that's part of where the district court went wrong in its second opinion here. Throughout the opinion, and indeed in the introductory paragraph, the district court said the Fifth Circuit reversed my denial of habeas relief. They've sent it back here for a hearing, an evidentiary hearing on this man's Strickland claim. So we're going to decide whether there was Strickland prejudice. But again, finding whether there's Strickland prejudice, it doesn't say one way or the other whether habeas relief should issue here because of the relitigation bar.
You might speak a little slower, number one. Number two,
Does
this mean that the state concedes that counsel was ineffective?
At this stage in the proceedings, I believe I am bound to so concede, and I apologize for speaking too quickly. Earlier government lawyers in the case did make that stipulation in the district court.
Okay. Just wanted to verify.
And we haven't briefed what the consequences of that stipulation would be, but we don't think that a federal court would even be bound by that stipulation to grant relief on a Strickland claim.
All right, I'd like you to deal with your opponent's argument that this would have been a completely different, at least a very different trial, if this evidence had been produced that the slug that was in the victim's head was a 22 rather than a 25 caliber. They argue that this would have shown that Guevara fired that shot. That'd be the reasonable conclusion. And there's some that together with their pathological evidence would have given a jury a reason to believe that death was caused by that 22 slug fired by Guevara rather than Williams. It also would have undermined, of course, Guevara was a state star witness, would have undermined Guevara's testimony that he didn't shoot it at Collier. So you would have had even if the state had, you know, you got a question, I suppose, whether if this evidence had come to light before the trial, whether the state would have even used Guevara as a witness. I mean, if he's a co-murderer, or he fired one of the shots that contributed to the death of the victim, would they have even called him? But if, let's just assume the trial would have gone on the way it did, the defense would have had some pretty powerful evidence to impeach him.
Well, there sure are a lot of questions in there, and I'll try to answer them slowly.
In other words, when you'd have a completely or very different trial, the structure of the trial would have been different. The federal habeas court could determine that undermines the confidence in the verdict if that's a conclusion.
The law of parties might have been become an issue. Guevara might have been charged himself with a different crime.
Right.
So showing that the trial would have proceeded differently is not enough even to show Strickland prejudice. I mean, that's going to be true in any Strickland case because the nature of the inquiry is to speculate as to how things would have gone if trial counsel had done something differently. So it's undoubtedly the case that if these forensic experts had been called, the trial would have looked different. But the question is whether there's a reasonable probability that the result would have been different.
What if Guevara would not have been called as a witness?
We think that we could that still wouldn't show that there's a Strickland prejudice claim here because there was evidence and testimony from Rasul, the man who William shot in the face with a pistol that night. There was testimony from Elaine Wynn.
No, he shot him in the foot.
With respect, that's incorrect, Chief Judge Jones. Williams pulled the .25 caliber pistol, and Rasul testified. Williams shot him in the face. Rasul did not die from his wounds, but started running away. And so we have testimony even setting aside the Guevara testimony. So with respect, I would push back on Judge Davis's characterization of Guevara as the state's star witness. That doesn't even square with the prosecutor's closing arguments. In the closing, the prosecutor said, you don't have to believe one word that Guevara said because we still have enough evidence to convict here.
But the main point there was it doesn't matter whether the shotgun killed him or the pistol killed him.
Well, no, because even there, Judge Davis, the prosecutor's case was when they were under the mistaken impression that EB1, the bullet in Collier's head, was from Williams' gun, even then the prosecution's case was that didn't kill Collier, and so Williams finished him off with the shotgun. So we had all of this testimony from Wynn, from Rasul, from Anderson, these other people who were witnesses to the events that occurred on May 13th, 1992, who said that Williams pulled the pistol and shot Rasul in the face. Rasul began running out of the woods, as I think any of us would do, having been shot in the face with a pistol. While he was running, he was then shot in the foot with a .25 caliber slug from Williams' pistol, and Guevara began chasing after him. Now, during this chase, that's when Collier was shotgunned in the face, and the testimony at trial, and even the omitted expert testimony that Williams says his lawyer should have brought, is that the shotgun was a cause of death, even if it wasn't the only cause of death. And so we have all of this evidence that showed that Williams and only Williams could have fired the shotgun. The testimony from Rasul and from Wynn in this case was that Williams was wearing, in addition to shorts and a T-shirt, an L.A. Raiders starter jacket, a bulky jacket, in which he had hidden a sawed-off shotgun in one of the arms. And that the testimony further from Rasul was that Guevara was wearing an unbuttoned silk shirt under which he could not have hidden a shotgun. So Williams was the only person who could have had the shotgun, and Williams was the only person who was in Collier's vicinity at the time parties heard the shotgun blast.
Now, Guevara was the only one who actually saw or testified that he saw the shotgun being shot by the defendant, though, huh?
With respect, Judge Davis, he didn't testify to that. Nobody, the only two people who could have witnessed the shotgun actually being fired were Williams and Collier. And, of course, neither of them are going to testify to that in this case for different reasons. Guevara testified that as he was chasing Rasul out of the park, he heard the shotgun blast. There was no eyewitness to the firing, but as a matter of Texas law, eyewitness testimony to that firing is not necessary.
The question isn't just prejudice. The question is whether the state court, there is a theory under which the state court could have reasonably concluded there was prejudice, according to Harrington.
Chief Judge Jones, that's exactly correct.
So what is that theory?
The theory is that the overwhelming evidence of Williams' guilt gave the CCA a reasonable basis for rejecting the Strickland claim at the prejudice prong. Because even if EB1 is attributed to Guevara's pistol, there was still overwhelming evidence that Williams and only Williams had the shotgun, and that Collier was shot with the shotgun while Guevara was chasing Rasul. And so even if it's true that Guevara is implicated in this murder, and even if it's true that there were two rather than one causes of Collier's death, as a matter of Texas law, that still makes Williams fully culpable for capital murder here.
Well, but you did not charge parties, though.
We didn't charge parties, but it's not necessary to charge parties. 604 of the Penal Code is not the parties charge. In addition, the speculation as to how the trial would have gone, as Judge Davis pointed out in a question, suggests that there would have been a lot of things that might have been done differently here. I would also add, though, in response to one of Judge Davis's earlier questions, that it's not even true to say that Guevara's testimony counts for nothing as a result of this forensic evidence, because that conclusion from the district court in its second opinion is based purely on speculation, and the CCA could have speculated to the contrary about the effect that this forensic evidence would have had on Guevara. Keep in mind, please, that Guevara actually admitted at the trial on cross-examination that he fired his pistol at Collier. He just said, I couldn't have hit him. Now, as Judge Atlas wrote in her first opinion in this case in footnote 90, the only thing that attributing EB1 to his gun does is give physical confirmation of what he had already admitted to doing. So for all of these reasons, then, as Chief Judge Jones' question points out, There is a reasonable basis for the CCA to have rejected the prejudice or the Strickland claim here on prejudice grounds.
You say that even without Guevara's testimony, the CCA could have reached that conclusion.
That's correct.
And you're willing to stand on that?
Yes, Judge Davis, we would stand on that. The CCA could still say that based on Wynn's testimony, based on Rasul's testimony, there was evidence as to who had the shotgun, there was evidence as to the chase, and the CCA could reasonably conclude that the prejudice inquiry has not been satisfied. Judge DeMoss, I'm sorry.
Do we know? My understanding is that the CCA's opinion is very vague as to why they ruled as they did. Is that true?
That is true. It's a two-page summary disposition, essentially. But as the Supreme Court held in Harrington versus Richter, that doesn't really matter for purposes of determining reasonableness under 2254D. What this court has to do, as Chief Judge Jones' question earlier pointed out, was this court, in any federal court, should figure out what are the possible bases on which a reasonable court could have based its rejection of the claim. And then unless any of those are eliminated as reasonable bases, habeas relief can't issue.
They did allude to the idea that there was sufficient evidence to convict him, right?
In the
harmless error.
In the direct appeal, I believe that's at tab H of the record excerpts. There was an argument on direct appeal that Guevara was an accomplice and that his testimony couldn't be taken into account. And in fact, on direct appeal, the CCA said that even with just Rasul's testimony, they could affirm the conviction. Briefly, if I could, so that I can give my friend in opposition a chance to respond.
Well, let me ask one more question. It is my understanding that the state habeas proceeding concluded that there was sufficient evidence of prejudice from the ineffective counsel to justify granting habeas. Is that correct?
That's partially correct, Judge DeMoss. The state trial court that was responsible for giving recommendations made that recommendation, but the CCA rejected that recommendation. Now, just very briefly, our argument in the alternative in this case is that even if you assume that the federal courts have authority to grant habeas relief here, discretion should be used to not to grant that. And we have yet to hear a response from my friend in opposition as to why habeas relief should issue.
Well, then maybe that's because we have yet to hear a case that supports that contention.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Ollie.
May it please the court, Mark Ollie for the appellee, Walter Long at the council table also for the appellee. I want to start off by mentioning some of the extraordinary circumstances of this case, just six quick points before getting into some rebuttal to the state's representations. This is an unusual and a troubling case. I think we all can agree to that. As we started this off, number one, the state has stipulated to ineffectiveness. Number two, the actual criminologist, Baldwin, who testified at trial as a failsafe that Val shot that didn't shoot that bullet, flipped in post-conviction proceedings and said that he did. The state's prosecution theory was completely wrong, and the one he labeled, quote, stupid, was completely correct. That's troubling in this case. The prosecutor's statement that Mr. Williams placed a shotgun against the victim's head and shot him, that's not true.
Well, he shot him at pretty close range.
Shot him within 4 to 8 feet. That's correct. And I've got a response to
that was a fatal shot.
It could have been a fatal shot. The testimony was conflicting on, either one could be a fatal shot, was the testimony. Oh. And right. And this is really troubling and very unusual. Two trial court judges, one state, one federal, say this was prejudicial, hearing basically the same evidence, except the federal judge heard a testimony from the state's representative that was negative to the petitioner. So two trial court judges who are used to looking at this sort of testimony saying this is prejudice in Texas is very unusual, and I think is probative of whether the CCA's decision was unreasonable. And as Your Honor mentioned, everyone knows that this case would be totally different if tried today. The state cannot put their trial back together. It has been destroyed. They could have another trial, and we can talk about how it might look, but this trial and its proof is shattered. What I think we should look at, and I'm more than happy to look at the CCA's decision and see whether it was reasonable under Strickland, what the prosecutor did to convince the jurors not to agonize about who shot who, and that's the prosecutor's words. Without this testimony, they would have agonized, according to the prosecutor, was Guevara's testimony, the failsafe from Baldwin, and mocking the defense. And if we start with Guevara, my gun couldn't reach that far, quote. It was impossible for me to shoot that far. Is there any way you shot Collier? No, I didn't. Is there any way that you could be responsible for his death? No. So that's Guevara. The prosecution is trying to convince who shot who. Baldwin, quote, there was no way in the world, based upon his training, expertise, and the examination he made, that bullet was shot out of Guevara's .22 caliber Magnum. Closing argument. Only two people could have done this, the prosecutor, Val or the defendant. I don't want to bore you. I don't want to waste your time. It just ain't that. He goes on. It couldn't have been Val. That leaves Nane and Williams. Again, there's a failsafe involved in all of this. That's why we forward all the firearms evidence to Bob Baldwin. So don't agonize. There's a failsafe. It doesn't matter. Well, if there's no failsafe, then there's agony. And the jurors would have been required to agonize over what the facts were in this case. But what Baldwin said.
I guess I have a problem with. Well, go ahead.
Okay. And then he refers to Baldwin. He says he told you absolutely, positively certain they couldn't be fired out of that Derringer. Now they say, in their post-hearing brief in the district court, that Val is a killer. They say it in their post-hearing brief, and it is quoted at tab D at 21. Val's a killer in this case. They disavowed him as a killer at trial, and everything they did was intended to persuade them that he wasn't, and it's false. And this is what the prosecutor says about what the truth is. No, it's absurd, almost to insult your intelligence talking about it. You don't need to agonize over whether the star witness shot the victim. This is just stupid, absurd, and insulting, so don't agonize over it. But now we know it's the truth. And so the agony should have been there for these jurors, and that proves prejudice, and that the decision of the...
Let me ask you a question. I mean, this is sort of the... there's no question this is a troubling case.
No question.
But if you rolled back the clock and you tried it with Guevara being an admitted shooter, you still have... The best you can do with your forensic evidence is he got killed by two things at the same time. And William shot him in the face. He shot Razul in the face. He shot Razul twice. This man is a danger to society. How is any jury going to come out differently? Well, I mean, so what is the overall benefit to the system?
He shooting the survivor, Razul, says nothing about the non-survivor, other than you're right, he was shooting somebody.
Well, he sure wasn't trying to just give him a warning. Shot him in the face.
But who started what? You know, it depends on who you believe. There was a lot of gunfire going on out there. He could have been shooting Rasul.
Two guys
to
on
defend
one
himself.
Side shot two guys on the other. There's no plausible self-defense.
Well, actually, Guerrero says the reason he shot is because he saw someone else going for a gun, and that's all the gunfire started
up.
I'm
going to let you do your argument, but to me, it's a question of how far does Harrington go, because Harrington says if there is a conceivable, rational basis on which the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals could have denied relief, then under AEDPA, we are bound to respect the judgment of the state courts. And then, you know, admittedly, Harrington is a different case on the facts. How far do we go in saying that procedural irregularities alone, even if there is a conceivable basis, can render that judgment infirm?
You know, if what is required is a rare extreme malfunction, which is what Richter and Harrington says, where is there one besides this? The very theory was false. And as was found by the state post-conviction court, the jury could have decided to believe the portion of Krause's testimony stating the complainant was dead before the shotgun. That's finding number 50, record excerpt G. And so the jury was entitled to do that. It would be unreasonable under Strickland and under Porter for the CCA to say, no, a jury couldn't deny
that. We clearly are not bound by that finding, however, because the Court of Appeals evidently rejected that.
But the district court found the same thing.
I understand that, but there's some history. She found that after a de novo hearing, too.
Well, my response to that is, the panel opinion, I believe, I don't think the panel and Judge Haynes would have remanded this case if they did not believe that if the facts were true that were found by that state post-conviction court, if that was true, it was unreasonable of the CCA to not grant relief.
Well,
I can't believe they did.
Well, you can't. I mean, I don't think Williams 1 holds much purchase for us because it was decided before Cullen. It's clearly wrong in ordering a hearing in light of Cullen. So I just, I don't think.
Could I
and
be
they
heard
made,
on that part, at least?
Sure.
It seems to me that these judges would not remand to a district court if they thought the facts, as alleged, wouldn't require relief and that to hold otherwise would be contrary or unreasonable. And I think that's what they did. They may not have done it artfully, but when Judge Haynes says a state court's decision is an unreasonable application if it correctly identifies the governing rule but applies it unreasonably to the facts of the case and then goes through the facts of the case and says, well, we don't know what's true or false, that to me suggests if these facts are true, then that was an unreasonable determination. So we got to find out if these facts are true. So I think we crossed through D before going to the district court.
Go along with me and answer me about Harrington, please.
I thought I had. That's what I was trying to do.
Well, you can't. I don't think it's sufficient to go back to Williams 1.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, that's just, go ahead.
All right. Well, let me address one of the state's primary points in their last presentation, and that is that without Carrera, there's sufficient evidence to find that the petitioner, the defendant, the appellee, did this shotgun blast. At page 35 of their brief, they say the undisturbed trial evidence showed beyond a reasonable doubt that Williams and only Williams could have fired the shotgun at Collier's head. And then at page 51, they say again, Wynn and Rasul placed the shotgun in Williams' hands at all times during the flurry of gunshots. Not true. If you go to the record, page 149 of the trial, the defense presentation is vividly illustrated when Wynn is questioned on cross-examination. She says, that's who I saw leave out the car with it, the shotgun. They could have exchanged at any time while they were in the wooded area. I cannot say who shot who. She doesn't say whose hands the gun was in. Then particularly, she gets the question, particularly if Val said his gun jammed, did he go for the shotgun? That is what you're saying? Answer, correct. So it's entirely possible that the gun was exchanged to him at any place. Answer, correct. She can't say. None of her testimony says. And Rasul does not hear a shotgun as he's running. He hears shots. So Rasul can't tell us anything about a shotgun blast. The shotgun blast is Val and Val alone.
Most people can tell the difference between a shotgun blast and a pistol blast.
That was his testimony. I just heard shots. He didn't say anything about a shotgun. He didn't say anything about seeing a shotgun. And in his pretrial statement to the police, he told the police that the defendant was wearing a T-shirt. And that's somewhat inconsistent with a football jacket where you could hide a gun. He never said to anyone that he saw a gun on Nathan Williams.
When, if we're hypothesizing what was unreasonable and so on, do we pay no attention to the witness, the Smith fellow who came forward later on?
That was the panel decision last time, and the state has made much to do about that. And I think that we do not pay attention to that, and I think that Strickland says as much, that you look back at the prior proceeding and, given the error, can you rely on the outcome of that proceeding? Did it have an adverse effect on that defense, on that proceeding, et cetera? But the one thing that's crucial about Smith that the state has left out of their briefs, and you won't find it in our brief, but he was granted immunity when he testified in 1998 and 2000. They didn't have to get up here and say to you, oh, we guarantee you he'll get immunity. And if he gets immunity, what will the jury do with that testimony? This is noted in the lower court opinion, tab E at page 53, the first opinion. Smith was granted immunity to testify both times, and he didn't show up at all. He vamoosed for the first trial, and he was Val's friend. So this immunity is a real kicker for the state, and I'd like to hear their response to it and why it wasn't in their briefing. The person would not testify until he negotiated immunity in 1998 and 2000, and I think the jury would take that with a huge grain of salt. The friend of the person who shot the person in the head with a .22 has to be given immunity to say the other person shot with the shotgun? I mean, that is prejudicial, and so I think we shouldn't consider Smith, and even if you do, his credibility is probably as low as Val Herrera's.
Guevara.
Counsel,
yes.
Do we know whether or not the CCA opinion was unanimous?
There was not a noted dissent. I don't know what the procedure normally is. It was just an order that says we do not believe that some of the crucial fact findings and the recommendation based on them are supported by the evidence.
Was it signed by any judge?
We don't think so. I'll have to check that to be sure. I don't remember a signature.
I don't.
If I can have a moment.
Let me ask you this. Do we, maybe you talked about this earlier, should we, in weighing prejudice or hypothesizing as to whether the state court had grounds for finding no prejudice. Do we look at the trial with all the witnesses who testify and just look at that previous proceeding, or was the TCCA entitled to look at it as what most likely would have happened, or how do we look at it?
I think you have to look at it that nothing that happened can we be assured would have happened that way.
You know, if they charged him with money laundering, it would be okay.
Pardon? You know, we could go back to this trial and they could negotiate with Nathan Williams and he'd be the witness. He'd be testifying.
Yeah. Well, we can't hypothesize like that, can we?
Well, I mean, there's got to be a certain amount of speculation, and the other side has a certain amount of speculation. My speculation is there would be a plea in the case. Because I don't think you really can assess, and I think the record reflects you can't assess fairly with the evidence that's out there, both the lay and the expert, who's responsible for what. And so the jury would be faced with that, and the prosecution would be faced with that, and the prosecution would be faced with a witness who never said, I shot the guy. He said, I didn't shoot the guy.
Well, but, excuse me, but we've had other death penalty cases where both of them got convicted of capital murder. This man was under 17, but
right.
Both of them shot what should have been a lethal shot into the head, and both convicted of capital murder, so I don't think you can.
Well, it depends on who testifies. And you know, Val can testify if he wants to, but he's not going to be believed. And he's the primary witness for the state. So is there a reasonable probability? And the language that I think that sometimes we lose sight of is this verdict worthy of confidence? Look back at that verdict. And under Richter and under Penholster and under Strickland, is it worthy of confidence? And if you have confidence in this verdict based on what you've heard about it, and think that a reasonable jurist could or a fair-minded jurist could, then, you know, we lose. But if no fair-minded jurist could find that, A, an expert was the fail-safe to keep them from agonizing, but in fact he wasn't a fail-safe, so they needed to agonize, that the prosecutor had a case that turned on Val not being the shooter, and it's unreasonable for that trial, bottomed on that witness not shooting someone in the head, it's unreasonable that that would still be reliable when he in fact did shoot him in the head. And the medical examiner, state court found jurors could have believed the credible testimony of the medical examiner that the victim was dead when shot with the shotgun. So under those circumstances, however the case might be tried in the future, it doesn't appear to me that that's a verdict worthy of confidence. And again, I can't conceive of, you know, I've been practicing a long time and you folks have been looking at a lot of cases. This is a messed up case. It's clearly a rare, extreme malfunction in the state criminal justice system. And our contention is it would be an unreasonable application of Strickland and common sense to disagree with that finding.
How's it different than the facts of the incompetence in Richter, alleged incompetence, which had to do with the blood, not testing a blood sample?
Well, in Richter, the state court record was taken as true, and they assumed it was true, and there was no concession on prong one. There was no prejudice evidence, and so prong one was a large part of the analysis in that case, that counsel didn't have to go out and find someone. How the prejudice played out in that case, in this case, are different cases. Here, the prejudice plays out a reasonable juror, on a fact finding, a reasonable juror could have decided that the first shot was a killing shot. And I think that's significantly different in kind than where did someone fall based on blood splatter at a crime scene. This is someone else killed the victim, I didn't. And so I think that's a huge difference between this case and Richter.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Allen.
Thank you.
Back to you, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you. I'll try to take it real slow with my 5 minutes here. My friend in opposition says that this is a remarkable case and that there are remarkable factors, but these were all before the CCA when it rejected this Strickland claim on habeas review.
Counsel, let me ask you, what do we know about the vote of the CCA?
I believe tab E of the record excerpts does not reflect a signature on the opinion. It says do not publish and there are no recorded dissents. So from this, I would infer that it was unanimous. So the first thing I'd like to correct from my friend in opposition.
Why was it not published? Is that routine?
I believe it is routine. I believe the CCA processes quite a few of these, and so they will have a number of them that are unpublished.
And they treat all the same as far as publishing? This is a case that's got so many unusual aspects to it that I would have thought that a reasonable court would have published and have stated fully what they were deciding.
From this side of the lectern, it is difficult for me to try to speculate as to how other judges should have written their opinions, Your Honor. But I don't think that there was actually that much that was remarkable about this. The testimony that Williams said...
If I'm correct that the state habeas trial judge recommended granting relief.
Yes.
Is that true?
That's correct.
And that was not addressed at all in the CCA's opinion.
That's correct as well. And Harrington versus Richter holds that a summary disposition doesn't have any effect on whether 2254D applies. So the expert testimony that Williams said his lawyer should have brought in this case was essentially a pathologist who would have testified to what? Well, the testimony that was before the CCA when it rejected the Strickland claim was testimony from Dr. Krauss that said that the shotgun blast fired by Williams was a cause, but not the only cause, of Collier's death. That makes Williams fully culpable for the murder of which he was convicted. Now, the notion that there's some question of who shot the shotgun in this case, that theory wasn't even adopted by Judge Atlas in this case when she granted habeas relief. And so we believe that it is difficult to say that the state court was unreasonable not to have gone down that road. Now, some of the questions from the bench from my friend in opposition correctly pointed out that the district court has violated Cullen versus Penholster in this case by relying on evidence that was not before the state court when it rejected the Strickland claim. And the holding of Cullen versus Penholster is that, quote, review under 2254D1 is limited to the record that was before the state court that adjudicated the claim on the merits.
Well, what if the trial would have been totally different or considerably different? If this evidence had come out, I mean, to evaluate whether it would undermine confidence in the verdict, don't we have to look at whether at the likely process that trial would have undergone?
Yes, I mean, that's the nature of the Strickland prejudice inquiry. But then what the court has to do under 2254D and Harrington is you have to determine what a reasonable court in the CCA's position could have concluded. And so you look at what the state court had before it, and then you speculate without doing too much speculation, as this court's precedent shows, and you try to determine could any reasonable court have rejected the Strickland claim. And I would make one other point, playing off of one of the questions that Chief Judge Jones asked about the effect of Smith's testimony in this case and whether that could have factored in Strickland. We haven't challenged the Williams 1 panel from this court's holding that Smith's testimony is irrelevant to the Strickland prejudice inquiry because it's probably law of the case. But this court's holding on that point is not the same thing as clearly established law from the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, the point is, if the case were retried, Smith would arguably be available as a witness, right?
That's correct. Smith would now be available as a witness, and the CCA could have reasonably and without violating any clear holding of the Supreme Court concluded that the Smith testimony does count for purposes of determining Strickland prejudice. And there's no question that the Smith testimony makes this a rather simple case. He testified that he heard a pistol shot, saw Collier go to the ground, saw Guevara chasing after Rasul, heard a shotgun blast, turned and saw Williams standing over Collier with a smoking gun, having just dispatched him with that shotgun. So,
how do we weigh the fact that this is an immunized witness who's testifying, and in effect, all that would have on his believability to the jury?
I'm not sure that that would really have any effect. I think that that would probably be the classic prisoner's dilemma situation in which somebody is given immunity in return for testimony. And even if it would...
Guevara had plea bargained too, hadn't he?
Yes, he pled to, I believe, a 10-year sentence on contribution to a drug transaction. And incidentally, the statements from the prosecutor regarding Guevara's plea are one of the many reasons the district court violated Cullen versus Penholster, because the letter from the DA to the parole board about Guevara was not before the state court. But my time has expired. We would urge the court to reverse and render.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. We have your case. Mr. Olive, your